aerospace and defense manufacturing.
Machines and automation.
Additive manufacturing.
Smart manufacturing.
A global manufacturing economy.
Welcome to Advanced Manufacturing Now, the podcast for manufacturing professionals. From the design screen to the shop floor to final assembly, we drive the conversation for making manufacturing smarter. Powered by SME, connecting people who are passionate about manufacturing. Visit us at advancedmanufacturing.org.
Hello, and welcome to Advanced Manufacturing Now, the podcast for manufacturing professionals. I'm your host, Chris Mayhart, Associate Editor, and we're joined today at South Tech 2019 in Greenville, South Carolina by David McPhail, President and CEO of Memex Incorporated. We're talking about how manufacturers can utilize technology to improve efficiency, reduce downtime, and boost productivity and profits across their business. Thanks for joining us, David. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So, for those of our listeners that may not be familiar with Memex, can you tell a little bit about the company, brief history, how you got started into it?
Absolutely. So, Memex is a technology company. We're a software and hardware company. We sell pretty much exclusively to manufacturers. And what we do is, our tagline pretty much says it all. We measure manufacturing excellence.
So, you guys are really working in the, Industry 4.0. I know you work on efficiency of machines, measuring that, measuring downtime, helping understand what sort of case studies are there or a customer breakthrough that has utilized your technology and perhaps seen that they may not have expected from it.
Well, yeah, we have quite a few of them. I can give one in particular. So we had one customer that had just started with a 3-machine pilot, which is not unlike most of our customers in the way they start. They start small and then they connect their equipment over time. And this one particular customer had a constraint. They had 3 machines that were going full out and they couldn't get the parts out to the customer that they needed to get the parts out to. And so we put our technology on and we measured the efficiency of those 3 machines. They were about to purchase a 4th machine just because they were capacity constrained.
Sure.
And basically what we did was we found that all of their programs had a whole bunch of M0s and M01s in them, and why they were in there was about 5 years ago when they proofed out the part. They just left them in there. They didn't change them. And when they went through and they streamlined their process, and you can appreciate these parts are very long, some cases 10, 12 feet long. They take 48 hours for a roughing cycle. And what they would do is they took 2 of the operators and put them in a different part of the factory and let one operator run 3 machines. And you can appreciate these very expensive forgings when they're either craning them in or craning them out or doing a test and another machine stops. It's approximately 50 yards away. They wouldn't walk over there and hit the cycle start button, so that machine just sat there and collected downtime. Okay. And when they saw this, what they did was they went back and they triaged their programs and put a gritzu of people together internally and removed all these M0s and M01s and created approximately a $40,000 per month pickup on just a 3-machine install. So that was an incredible return on investment, and subsequent to that, we ended up installing on a significant amount more of their equipment, not just in that plant, but in other plants as well.
Well, you can imagine, it's the same as when you look at maintenance and downtime on your machines, really being able to understand why a machine isn't working. There's a ton of manufacturers out there who all they understand is I can't get the amount of work done on what I have, so I might need to add another machine, another worker, which even in this tight job market, adding that machine isn't just the cost of the machine, but it's now finding another body perhaps to run that and train them and be able to run into those. So, you mentioned that they saw about $40,000 a month, an improvement from that. Is that a sort of normal ROI that a business might see? Is that pretty standard?
It's pretty standard. Typically, our internal return rate is 300% or a 4-month payback. We've done this a few hundred times. We have lots of customers, whether they're high mix, low volume, low mix, high volume, whether they're making aerospace parts or automotive parts or their fabrication, construction equipment. This technology is ubiquitous in its application. It doesn't really care what type of machine it's being installed on. It also doesn't really care what type of product the company makes. There's 3 things in every factory that are constantly in flux. You mentioned one of them, the people. The second one is the product that the company makes, and the third one is the equipment that they make it on. Sure. And anytime any one of those 3 legs, I guess I call them 3 pillars of manufacturing, change, productivity usually suffers. The last stat I'll give you is most companies think they're 65% capacity utilized. The ones that are humble will say that there's room for improvement. The actual reality is when you measure it, there's on average sub 40%. So there's a perception reality disconnect with respect to how companies think they're operating their equipment and what their operational excellence is versus what it's actually is once it's effectively measured.
So say I'm a shop owner. I might already be measuring some of this information. I've got paper logs. I'm asking my employees to tell me what's going on when a machine's down. Why do I need to turn that over to a computer system?
Well, for a number of reasons. First of all, manual data collection is latent, and it's usually chronically inaccurate. We had one customer that used to do that, and what they did is they put a small whiteboard at the end of every machine, and the operator was responsible for writing down every time they were in a setup mode or whether they were down for a downtime longer than a couple of minutes. And when you watch that behavior, what would actually happen is if the shift ended at 3:30, at 3:20, the operator's writing down a whole bunch of numbers on the whiteboard, and it's basically, I think I was in setup for 20 minutes, and I think I was this, and I think I was that. So the reality is the data, not only is it latent, because you get it at the end of the shift, and you can't do anything about it at the end of the shift other than say, I'll do better on the next shift. And the second thing is it's usually chronically inaccurate.
Well, if you think about it, it's not anything against the workers, but if there's a reason for downtime, sometimes depending on what that is, they may not want to report that, and they may not get that into the final report.
Yeah, the other thing I'll say is when you use continuous improvement methodologies and you're using that data to support your CI initiatives, you're making really bad decisions because you don't have real-time data, you don't have an objective version of the truth, you have a subjective one, and again, it's latent. So, you know, for example, if you were monitoring this information in real time and you saw that a setup was longer than, say, an hour and that was your benchmark, you could do something about it at 11 o'clock in the same shift as opposed to finding out at 3:30 that you spent longer than an hour on that setup, and then the next time you do that job, you've already got, you may not do that job every day. You might do that job once every 2 weeks, once every 3 weeks. That information is lost at that point.
So we're talking about pulling information out of a machine. In the United States here, one of the big data standards that a lot of machines use is MT Connect. What is your guys' relationship like with MT Connect?
So we were involved with MT Connect way back when it started in 2010. At IMTS in 2010, we actually connected a 25-year-old at that time, FANUC 11 control, to the Emerging Technology Center, which was on the other side of IMTS. We were in the East Pavilion, and we were able to stream data from it. And subsequent to that, we were asked to be part of the MT Connect Institute, which we accepted. And we contributed by co-chairing. I personally co-chaired both the working groups that produced the first two white papers that MT Connect put out. One of them was the connectivity guide, and the other one was What's In It For You. And both of them are getting started under the guise of getting started with MT Connect. So we've been huge proponents of MT Connect. And you know, for a company like ours, or we're a software company, best use of our time isn't writing drivers to every single small machine tool vendor that has a proprietary protocol. The best use of our resources is to actually create a business use case that creates value for our customer. If you have MT Connect, you can do that. If you don't have MT Connect, you have to spend the time to write the driver. And because it's proprietary information to you, you're certainly not going to share it with your competitor. So it really just opened up the landscape. It lowered the barrier to entry for companies. It actually lowered the cost for our target customer. We can't say enough good things about MT Connect.
That's great. Now, a lot of manufacturers, especially smaller manufacturers, tend to get a little hesitant when we start talking about connecting machines, adding all this infrastructure and this IT. You know, and I think a lot of times manufacturers think it's really only the huge, large companies that can actually afford to do this. So is there a certain size manufacturer that can benefit from this technology? You know, do they need to have a huge IT staff to be able to implement Memex's technology and see this information in real time?
No, our technology can run on-prem or in the cloud. So it can run on a server that's behind the firewall of the company. It can run in the cloud. It can connect to any single asset. Whether you're low mix, high volume, high mix, low volume, whether you're making aerospace parts or construction equipment, whether you're a job shop, we've got customers in almost every single vertical that I just mentioned, and more than one. And in every single case, really what we're talking about here is increasing the capacity utilization of the factory, identifying the constraints, fueling your continuous improvement programs with real-time data, and then being able to benchmark and repeat. Because as I said earlier, there's three things in any factory that are constantly changed. You mentioned one of them, the people. Let's say that the company has a bunch of people that are long in their careers and are about to retire, and you have the new guard coming in. what happens with all that tribal knowledge that, that walks out the door? There's no possible way that that person can educate the incoming person with all the information that they have about having worked at a company for 30 years. So how do you collect all that information? So if you're monitoring the process and you see what's working and your continuous improvement initiatives are fed with real-time data, then productivity usually can sustain and be sustained over the change of staff or the change of equipment or the change of product.
So you've mentioned a few different industry verticals. Are there a set of industry verticals that might be able to utilize this better than others?
We tend to find companies that have high loaded labor costs are probably a target for us. And we started in the aerospace industry for that reason. The average aerospace loaded labor cost is somewhere between $175 and $225 an hour. And so every hour that you can save them is a big number. And so when you take a non-productive hour and turn it into a productive hour, but again, our average internal return rate is 300% or a four-month payback. And that's on average across all the customers that we work with and all the different verticals that we work in. So again, the technology itself is pretty ubiquitous in its application, pretty consistent in its ability to generate a return on investment. A 10% increase in OE usually equates to a 20% increase in EBITDA.
That's impressive. So you talked about continuous improvement. You talked about how paper records are latent. So how does real-time data really allow continuous improvement to better match its potential maximum return for a manufacturer?
So if you think about just give you one example. So let's think about a Kaizen event for a minute. A lot of companies are doing Kaizen work, which is essentially going to the shop floor and looking at the process and coming up with methods of collecting some data, manually aggregating it, looking for some opportunities to improve, developing a countermeasure, implementing that countermeasure, collecting and aggregating more data to approve to determine whether it's accretive or neutral, and if so, make it part of standard work. It's a seven-step process. And if you have the real-time data to support a culture of continuous Kaizen, you're down to five steps. Because really what you're doing is you're running a report, you're looking at a trend, you're developing a countermeasure with real-time data that's objective, not subjective. You're then implementing that countermeasure, running another report a few hours later or a day later, and then if it's accretive or neutral, you're making it part of standard work, and you're continuously doing this. You're not setting an event, every month we're going to do a Kaizen event. No, every day we're going to run reports, every day we're going to look at the data, and we're going to make changes based on what the data tells us. Because again, there's three things that constantly change. I keep going back to that, but the reality is a lot of people think factories are not dynamic. They're very dynamic. People change, equipment changes, products change.
Absolutely. So a little earlier you mentioned on how it doesn't matter what the machine is. It's ubiquitous and sort of vendor neutral. How do you guys achieve that?
We have a five-step process to success. The first step is Connect. And in that step, we have the ability to take data from MT Connect, we already talked about, but Fanuc Focus as well, and OPC. So that covers all of the predominant electronic protocols. And then for every other piece of equipment that doesn't have, in some cases, an Ethernet jack or doesn't have any one of the three protocols I mentioned, we have a hardware device that turns that machine into a web server. And so we are able to collect data from every single piece of equipment that's on the factory floor, regardless of its maker, its genre, its year, or vintage. We have some machines that are built in the 1930s that we collect data from. We've installed our equipment on drum relay controlled machines, which are from the 1940s. It's incredible. Some of the production equipment that's still very valuable production equipment that's being utilized today. People aren't just going to change the equipment because it doesn't have the latest, greatest protocol on it.
Sure. So, when you get into this space, you start hearing things like Industrial Internet of Things, IoT, Industry 4.0. They're all really sort of similar concepts, but can you inform us a little bit about how they're related and different?
Yeah. So Industry 4.0 was coined by the European government, specifically the German government, in 2010. IoT was coined by MIT in 1999. And IIoT, I couldn't find a stat on that, but GE and Cisco kind of lay claim to the invention of the acronym IIoT, Industrial Internet of Things. I get asked this question a lot, and the question usually comes from a senior executive. They'll ask me, they'll say, I've been told by my operational management team I need to do this IIoT, I need to use Industry 4.0 technology, but I don't really understand what that means. And so I challenge them to think about it in terms of data-driven manufacturing as one business use case. There are many business use cases, but data-driven manufacturing, converging all three of those ideas, IoT, IIoT, and Industry 4.0, into dashboards and real-time data and analytics and artificial intelligence, all wrapped in under the umbrella of data-driven manufacturing, tends to resonate with people a lot more than these somewhat nebulous terms, IoT, IoT, or Industry 4.0.
Well, we certainly do love our acronyms. So another thing that you've mentioned throughout this a couple of times is low mix, high volume, high mix, low volume. Which is it?
Either one. So in a high mix, low volume environment where you have constant setups, where you're doing a lot of setups, so you're making 100 parts of this and then change out to 50 parts of that. If you know what your setup times are, and usually that's one of the biggest constraints in a high mix, low low volume shop, is that your setup times tend to be long, and if you're not measuring what they are, they'll be what they are. And most companies don't understand how to take that setup time and reduce it. Think of Schmed, single minute exchange of die. And also, if you are capacity constrained, for example, if your process is that you make the first part and first off inspection part, then it goes to a CMM and there's 9 other parts in front of it, and you're not measuring how much time you're losing as a result of waiting for QA inspection,
sure,
then you can't fix it. So you can't add another CMM or add another CMM operator if you have the equipment but don't have the operator. If you're measuring that, then you can remove that constraint and change your setup times. We've had customers do that. We've had customers take their setup times from half an hour down to 5 minutes or 7 minutes because the QA department now owns the time.
Sure. So I think one of the things that kind of popped out to me is, I think when companies think and manufacturers think about cutting down time, they're thinking about cutting time. They're thinking about chips. And you mentioned how you've put equipment and started pulling data out of machines from the 30s and 40s and how it can really go on every machine. So you're not just talking about when you're cutting, that there's other areas in the operations that they can find and make up time with. Can you tell us a little bit about how those non-cutting processes make an impact in reducing productivity on the shop floor?
So our typical customer will have more than one process. They'll have some chip cutting, they'll have some metal bending, they might have some fabrication, some of them have some plastic injection molding. Then you move on to value-added activities like deburring and assembly and things of that nature. So if you just looked at the cutting time, just the cutting chips, and you didn't look at, say, setup time, if you were looking at metal bending as an example, say a brake press, and you just looked at the amount of time that the RAM went up and down, your data set would look really choppy, because what happens when a press cycles and goes back up to the top and waits for you to cycle it again, the operator is doing something. They're actually taking the part, they're repositioning it, they're checking the bend, they may stroke the press again to either rebend the part, whatever. So if you're not actually able to track not just the time when the RAM's moving, but actually when the process is being worked on by the operator, and how we do that is really simple. We actually take a debounce approach, and so we'll trap the time high and hold that time in cycle for whatever, as you say, like every, I should never not bend a part every 60 seconds. So if I'm not bending a part every 60 seconds, then I have downtime. Otherwise, I'm completely okay. I'm in cycle. If you don't do it that way, you're going to look at a real choppy data set, which really won't tell you much. And that's the same for welding and the same for fabrication. When you look at manual assembly, things like value added, like you're taking all these machine parts and you're putting them into a sub-assembly, you can track the concept of assembly as a machine. You don't have an in-cycle condition to monitor, but the operator is your in-cycle condition, and the operator interfaces with a piece of software that tells us exactly what he's doing. And you can then look at that in a dashboard in a reporting environment, and it looks exactly the same as another machine.
So let's look at that operator for a second. A company wants to install your product. They want to start looking and pulling out this data. How much time does it take to bring those operators up to speed, to get them trained on utilizing this new platform?
4 hours. You can train an operator to use the operator portal in less than 4 hours, and usually it's a train-the-trainer approach. So we'll train somebody internally who then will train different shifts. Our adoption rate of our operator portal is about 97%. So
that's
it's
great.
A pretty high adoption rate, because it's very intuitive. It's very easy to use. There's only a couple of buttons you have to click to get anywhere. It's we realize that the operators job, primary job, is not to collect data. The operator's primary job is to actually produce parts.
Well, I don't think you can beat 4 hours when it comes to training. David, you shared a ton of great information. I know this is a lot that can help a lot of different manufacturers look at how their operations are performing. Want to thank you for your time. If listeners want to learn more about Memex, where should they go?
Our website is memexoee.com. That's memexoee.com.
And to find Advanced Manufacturing Now, visit us at advancedmanufacturingnow.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Advanced Manufacturing Now. If you liked what you heard, feel free to share the show and head over to iTunes, where you can write a review and subscribe to keep up with future episodes. Don't forget, you can join the conversation and learn more at advancedmanufacturing.org.